for exam two for computer science E1 will cover everything since exam one, from graphics, audio, video, streaming, security, XHTML, CSS, SSI, and a little bit of programming via JavaScript. Before we get started hot and heavy into the exam review, I just wanted to make sure that everybody was clear on podcasting and give you a demo of accessing the podcast via iTunes. As you know, on the course website, we have a section here called Podcast. And there's this nifty little orange button that says RSS and some jargon being thrown around about accessing the podcast either through iPod or iTunes. Well, what this is essentially is a special type of XML file. It's an RSS feed, specifically one whose rules were designed by Apple, where we just list serially all the media items that are available for download to the podcast. This really isn't meant for human consumption. This is meant to be ingested by a program so that it knows where to grab the podcast from and download them. So I'm going to do that with iTunes right now. I took some time this morning and installed it on this computer. It just installs, at least on Windows, you can go to the Start menu, Programs, iTunes. And then on the left-hand side here, you'll notice there's a whole bunch of sources you can choose from. I'm going to select Podcasts. And if you weren't particularly sure where, when, how, the ins and outs of using iTunes, you could certainly just go to the podcast directory. Some issues here. And find us in the education section. And the artist listed is, of course, David J. Malin. Right there. There's a subscribe button, so I would merely click on that. I get a confirmation dialog. I won't actually do it because I don't want to download all 10 or 11 of our lectures onto this computer right this very second. But as soon as I hit subscribe, yes, that's one of the options. You can configure iTunes to download only the latest one, so on and so forth. But in general, if you have found the podcasts useful, you can certainly download them and keep them. If you haven't been keeping up with the podcasts, this is how you would do it. Other applications are available out there, such as iPodder. You don't even need an application that's specific to podcasting. You can use any RSS reader, such as Mozilla Thunderbird. Okay. Just really quickly, I know that was whirlwind, but before we got started with the real meat of the stuff, I just wanted to make sure everybody was had at least been exposed to that. iTunes is, of course, available freely for download from the Apple's website.
Did you say free?
Freely, yes. It is free. I just went to apple.com. I'm going to click on the iPod and iTunes tab. I'm going to click on download. And then here's a download iTunes free button, and so on and so forth. I'm not actually going to do that right this second. because that's a little bit outside of the scope of the review. But again, just to expose everybody to it. Okay. Before we get started with the review proper, any questions, logistically speaking, about the exam? Nope. Okay. Well, we'll get started with graphics then. David talked about several file formats, BMPs, GIFs. Oops. JPEGs. And pings and TIFFs, and we'll start with that. It's a good idea in general to be familiar with these file types at least, BMP being a bitmap, if you'll recall the term. There's no compression with this file format. It is very large. It used to be, and to some extent still is, the standard for things like Windows wallpaper. GIFs have 256, or support 256 colors, are losslessly compressed. Support transparency. JPEGs were originally designed for higher quality images such as photographs. I'm having a bad spelling day. They are lossy compressed, and they support lots and lots of colors. Pings, or portable network graphics, also support a lot of colors. This file format was originally developed. The intention was that it was an alternative to the GIF file format, where there were issues in use based on licensing issues and disputes. It, too, is lossless and supports transparency. TIFFs, or tagged image file format, is a high resolution, very high resolution file format. This is what's called archival quality, something that will stand, something that can be stored for a very long time and still come out looking very, very good. With long-term storage, with some of these other file formats, you run across something called bit rot, but that's a tangent. There is also, can I erase this? Are you guys all set with this? Yes?
Or lossy?
They're not, you don't have to really think of them as being compressed, so lossless, lossy doesn't apply because it's not really compression involved. Any other questions? we hinted at it very briefly when I mentioned bitmap, but there's the idea of bitmap versus vector graphics. An approach to a bitmap file format image would be to define pixel by pixel this is red, this is green, this is yellow, this is blue, pixel by pixel. So it doesn't scale very well if you were to blow up this image, zoom into it, for example. It would come out looking very blocky. With vector graphics, the image is defined sort of mathematically so that it scales well no matter what the size is. Rather than saying I've got 5 or 6 pixels across, it says for however many pixels across, perhaps 1/10 should be red, 1/10 should be blue, 1/10 should be yellow, so on and so forth. That's a little bit of an oversimplification, but it's the basic premise behind it. And it's important to know that this is done mathematically.
I'm sorry, I didn't get the last sentence. It supports
vector graphics are this is done mathematically,
okay,
as opposed to pixel by pixel. It's important, too, to get a good understanding of compression, lossy versus lossless. Lossy compression results, well, either lossy or lossless compression results in smaller file sizes so that they're easier to handle, more efficient. But lossy compression results in the loss of some information. Inherently, the file quality is not as good with lossy compression. If, as per Dan's workshop about digital photography, if you took the raw output from a camera and converted it to a JPEG, the JPEG will never look as good as the raw version or perhaps a TIFF version, because it is lossy compressed. Lossless compression has an advantage of resulting in smaller file sizes, but the compression is handled in such a way that no information is lost. And David used the example of a flag. If we had a flag of 3 colors, it can define the first row of pixels as being a color. It can say, you know, the first X rows or the first third of the image vertically, the first third rows of the image vertically should be a certain color. The next third of the image horizontally should be a certain color, and then the last third of the image horizontally should be a certain color. You never result in a loss of information here. using the contrasting examples of the German and French flags, he also mentioned that this image will result in a larger file size than this image because you can only go so far before you have to encode more information horizontally. Okay. That was a whirlwind tour of graphics. I know we've compressed that a lot, but we have about 10 topics to cover. So we've only got about 5 or 10 minutes per topic, but I'm happy to entertain questions right now before I turn the floor over to Roman.
Covering audio at all?
Oh, yes. Any other questions? Yes.
No.
Oh, okay. Okay. Roman?
All right. So audio and video going right along. I'll erase this. So, audio formats. Let's start with the most basic one. It takes the least space. MIDI. We don't use it too often, but that was the one that when David tried to play Beethoven's Fifth, I believe, it didn't sound too well, because basically instead of the actual recording, the computer tries to reproduce the sounds the best it can, and it is essentially a synthesizer then. So it has some sort of programmed code for violins or cellos or any other instrument, and then all you input is the actual notes. You sort of program the file. So the computer in effect reads music, so you don't record the sound. You only give it the note, and then it plays the right note, or the combination of notes. So that typically doesn't take much space, but isn't also used for listening. It's more for creating music, synthesizing, and basically music creation packages, but not to produce music.
An Apple computer's GarageBand, which is something they put in the bottom bar now. That's what that file would be.
The question is this: on Apple computers, what's GarageBand? I'm not sure, actually.
You create whatever you want on it.
Yes, it's probably all kinds of software where you create music, where you write in notes, and there's lines. Yes, they do MIDI. Because you're not actually anywhere where you're quote-unquote creating music, you're not actually creating music unless you have an instrument in front of you and a microphone. So if you're just typing some keys in on a computer and then it produces music, it's got to be MIDI. Like the opposite of that is the WAV file format. It's not a pretty, not so good of a marker.
Is this a format, MIDI, or is it software?
The question is MIDI a format or a software? It's a format.
It's a format, okay.
Software would be called something like something Music Maker or your studio. There's hundreds of them, literally.
GarageBand would be one.
There was some kind of music producer, I don't remember what. WAV files, or just WAV, are quite the opposite. They're uncompressed audio files created for Windows. And if you plug a microphone to your computer and hit record on the sound recorder. Sound recorder is the standard utility, which you can access through program files. I think we tried to do it in lecture when David recorded his voice and then streamed it again. That is actually recording the waves. That's why it's called wave. You know, you produce sound, basically, sound waves, and the microphone picks them up. It's an analog device, but it converts them, digitizes them to a special format, wave, and then the computer is able to reproduce them, Windows specifically, but it's uncompressed, so it takes a lot of space. So what we usually use to play music on a computer is MP3s. And this is the most popular format for podcasting. Well, podcast essentially is an MP3. Podcast is a set of MP3s. But you can have standalone MP3s. Different types of software manages it. And there's MP3 players, but computers are generic devices to play MP3s. They are compressed, and they are well compressed, because if you compare, again, in lecture, David showed the actual CD track, and here's another format, CDDA. This is also an uncompressed format for audio players, for CD players. That are non-computer, actually. This was developed separately. You know, those CD players from 25 years ago, basically. They came up with a standard CDDA. So that's audio CDs. When you buy any audio CD today in a store, all the tracks are in CDDA format. And you wouldn't know that if you play it in a Sony CD player, because it hides any sort of format information from you. And usually Windows or Macs also hide it from you. They just show you track and track number. But if you actually view the extension, you would see CDDA. So I think if that particular movement of well, let's see. So the CD is 750 megabytes. So let's say there are, or 700 megabytes, there's a bit less on it. And if there are 10 tracks on a particular CD, it means each track, keep choosing bad markers, comes out to about 70 megabytes per track. And as we know, if you just look at a similar MP3 file, maybe it's 5 megabytes per track. So you can immediately see the difference. Now, how is this? Does this get compressed? Well, certain sounds that are indistinguishable to human ear are cut out. But also MP3s are of different qualities. So when you start up something like Winamp, which is a popular player, MP3 player, software for Windows or Macintosh, you see, typically, it shows the quality of the file, encoding in megabits per second. And 128 is the usual standard. Below, something like 56 megabits per second, is already maybe mono, so it's good for things like lectures, but not so good for quality music. And then you can have 256, 312. beyond that, it is virtually, the compression isn't much, so it approaches CDDA or wave. But 128, for most listeners, for most humans, it's fairly indistinguishable from anything higher than that. So this is the one typically used, which produces sizes of, say, 5 megabytes instead of 60 or 70. We also mentioned briefly AAC file format. I'm not sure you need to remember that, but that's for the iPod internal audio format. Then there's real audio, and that's a streaming file for a streaming audio file format. I have two A's. Goodness. The one, incidentally, is different from real video, but if you start, I think their extension is RM, if you start in, but I'm not sure about that, so I'll erase. If you start a streaming audio, real audio, through a real player, say a radio station on the internet, that means that you are not listening to a particular file. It is not like you're opening a file on your disk and listening to that track. That means that the content is actually streaming, and maybe you have a buffer of several seconds on your machine. So there's a wait time usually. And in fact, in most software, streaming software packages, including real audio, including real player, you'll see a loading buffer, you know, 15%, 50%, 75%, and 100%, and then it starts playing. Well, those few seconds is the time when the few seconds of content actually come from the server that streams the audio to your computer. And then the computer has those several seconds to play. So it starts playing them. While it's playing them, several more seconds are loading in. And also, once those few seconds are played, they're immediately discarded. They can be cached sometimes, but for streaming audio, that is atypical. So you can listen to pretty much anything for any amount of time, and you will not occupy space. So it's very convenient if you're sitting, well, first of all, for any sort of internet radio. There is no need, really, unless you like a particular program, to have audio files on your computer of those programs, say MP3s. And those are certainly available for some programs, but if you just want to stream, to use your computer as a radio, then real audio is the solution. Let's now go on to video. And since we're talking about streaming audio, then let's talk about streaming video too. Real video is the streaming video format. And this is the one you hopefully have all seen, because that's the standard at Harvard Extension School for broadcasting lectures. Now, this is not live broadcast, i.e. there's actually a file on the server. At Harvard Extension School, but when you view it, again, real player behaves the same way. And incidentally, it's the same software, real player. plays both real audio and real video files. Except when it plays real audio files, usually there's this pretty picture background or nothing. And if it's real video, obviously it plays the content. So real video, same idea, streaming, there's a buffer, several seconds are loaded. The audio channel is typically separate, but this is done behind the scenes for you. So there's an audio channel here and a video channel, and they stream simultaneously. Usually, audio content is considered superior in the sense that it's more useful. So if there's a network congestion, for example, and there is no way all of the content could stream to you in the next few seconds to show you, usually there's something jittery going on with the video content, but the audio content will stay intact. That is the reason. And it makes sense because usually what's said is more important than the viewing content. That was just what was decided for the protocol. And yes, that's again, lossy and lossless applies to compression. Here is definitely lossy because sometimes you don't even get specific frames, it just drops them. It doesn't even compress, it just doesn't stream them. Or the server streams them and the client doesn't receive them because of bandwidth congestion. So when it finally does receive them, already 5 seconds have gone and it just discards them. We were talking about compression, incidentally, as related to video files. And I'm almost tempted to pull up lecture slides. Let me do that quickly. Up in a second, hopefully. And there it goes. So this is a interframe and interframe compression. So in interframe compression, I have a keyframe, and then since background is unchanged, so the keyframe is some sort of background, and then the object is moving, so the software is smart enough to distinguish the moving parts, the changing parts, from the unchanging parts, and unchanging parts do not need to be restreamed, resent from the server to the client. And interframe is basically similar to graphics compression. You lose some content. supposing basically that humans will not notice. So you can skip some frames, for example, and it will still look like the image is moving. But if you paused it and looked at every frame, you would see that some frames are missing. My arm, instead of moving 1, 2, 3, maybe they moved 1, 2, 3 right away. But since it does this, you would notice in video.
So that distinction is what's lost in intra-frame?
Yeah, what is...
You kind of get a distinction between inter-frame and intra-frame, right?
Well, the first one is inter-frame, and the second one is intra-frame.
Frame script, which is what?
So intra skips frame.
Yeah, but pardon, I apologize. The first one is intraframe, and the second one is interframe.
Intra?
That is intra, because it's within a particular frame, you're losing some content. This is inter, I-N-T-E-R frame, because between frames you're losing one. I apologize. I don't know how you will remember that, though. Well, inter, maybe start with inter, and then intra would be the other one automatically. So interframe is between frames, you lose other frames. Yes?
Are there, I understand the conceptual difference here, but how do we relate that to particular formats in terms of video and aspects of compression? Or are we, is that beyond the scope of the...
But, how do you relate them?
Well, is there a particular format that uses intra-frame compression as opposed to a format that uses inter, or is that beyond the scope?
That is beyond the scope.
Okay.
And I would say most of them use both, probably, in some respect. We're only touching several ones anyway. We really care only about real video as a streaming video format. Some non-streaming video formats, can I erase this? Mm-hmm. Let's see. There were the MPEGs. These are just standards again. These caused a little bit of confusion because we have MPEG1, which is for downloads. And it's fairly low quality compared to some others. So this would be maybe, you know, video that you view on your computer is pretty lossy. MPEG2, on the other hand, is high quality. That's the one used on DVDs. So they were, from the start, very considered separate protocols, one for lower quality downloads for computers, and higher quality obviously takes much more space, so that's the one used on DVDs. But then came MPEG4, and that is a newer version of MPEG1. So it's better quality, but better quality than MPEG1, not better quality than MPEG2. So if you're asking for a high quality file, it's still this one, MPEG2.
So MPEG4 is still for downloads?
Yes, MPEG4 is also downloads. It uses better compression than MPEG1 and is hence better quality.
But not as good as MPEG2.
Yes, it I'm not even sure it uses compression, per se.
See, it's compressed.
Mm-hmm. Okay, QuickTime. QuickTime was developed by Macintosh, and that's the format for video podcasts. That's the one we use for video podcasts, for our video podcast too. And finally, there's a AVI, this is Macintosh developed, this is Microsoft, and it's what's called a container format, meaning it hides actually the specifics of the particular protocol inside it that is used for audio and video. It is a container protocol, but it has to be used in conjunction with what are called codecs that provide the actual format and compression for audio and video. Now, the key here for you, I guess, is just not to get lost between the different ones and maybe remember some key points. So here, for MPEG, 1 and 4 are downloads, 2 are DVDs. QuickTime and AVI are sort of competing formats from Microsoft and Apple, and they're non-streaming. Real video is streaming. Any questions before we go to on to security? Okay. Security. Oh. Anybody still remember that one? Yes?
Quick question. QuickTime is Mac, so Real Audio is PC-based?
Oh, Real Audio is both. The question is, what is Real Audio, or Real Video, for that matter? Is it Mac or PC? It's both. It's developed by an independent company. Called Real Media, I believe. Our discussion of security is going to be lossy because there is no way we can cover everything in this review session. In fact, though you might have not noticed, even the lecture discussion of it was lossy in a sense that the security field is just so huge. It would be very easy to have a separate course on it, even a separate introductory course on it. But let's see what we can try to do with the limited time that we have. First of all, first we're going to cover the threats and then some defenses. Slight aside about cookies. Not the ones you can eat, is that they were meant as a, most everything that is a threat to security other than malware, which we're going to talk about just a little later, is specifically written as malicious software. But many exploits it uses to actually corrupt your computer were meant to be positive features, good features. So that's how the good guys write something, but then there's a way for the bad guys to use what the good guys have written to actually run their attacks. So cookies, for example, were devised as very non-intrusive. Well, they're fairly intrusive, but they're not malicious pieces of information. This is just information that sites on the web save about your browsing habits. And it could be anything from your name if you type it in a form. Next time, well, for example, webmail. If you use a, not Harvard webmail, but say Gmail or Yahoo, and you don't want to type your username every time. Well, maybe you want to type your password every time, but suddenly you want to remember my username, and you click that little checkbox, remember my username. So Yahoo or Gmail is going to place a cookie in your browser cache. There's a special cookies file for every browser. And say, oh, this user visited me then, and every time this user visits me with this IP, remember their username and show it. Now, IP, incidentally, to figure out your IP isn't rocket science. So that is considered widely known. We highlighted that. Again, IP protocol was meant as a good thing, but it's fairly easy to exploit it, to at least know what IP you're coming from, because you're telling so. In every packet you send over the network, you're saying, my IP, host IP, is this, and I'm going there. There could be a different destination IP, and it's different for all websites, but the source IP, presumably, is going to stay the same unless you have a dynamic IP and it changes every 24 hours or something like that. But typically, an ISP assigns you an IP, a particular IP, and you just stick with it. So back to cookies, you know, Amazon saves your shopping preferences. Weather.com maybe saves, you know, how in weather.com you can bookmark a page where you see the 10-day forecast or maybe the hour-by-hour forecast. The next time you visit your town, it's your town, and it's either 10-day or minute-by-minute. So those are all cookies. Now, the way to exploit them is basically to collect information about you and then target you with ads. So it's used in conjunction with adware, maybe with phishing. And what's phishing? With a PH. Well, that's those special types of emails which try to fish with an F out of you, your financial information usually, or account information with the ultimate goal of, again, stealing your financial information. So they, Bank of the West with a double V, which we keep mentioning, sends you an email and says, you need to check your account right now, something's going on, please enter your username and password. You enter it, it's a completely different web page. And I encourage you to go back in lectures where David shows that, examples of those. They're in lecture slides and in their videos. But it's basically a hoax email. Yes?
Did you say there was a relationship between phishing and cookies?
Yeah, the question is there a relationship between phishing and cookies? Yes, in a sense that the phishing may target specific users based on cookie information. It is not necessary. Phishing, I would say, is they're not necessarily related. They could be. Phishing, as it's been done most recently, just targets everyone. Everyone being either a database of users' email addresses, a fairly random database, or just sending out random emails with all combinations of letters, just thinking that the user abcd@hotmail.com and then abce@hotmail.com and so on and so forth. So just billions of emails, and some of those are bound to hit real users. But for the databases, I said, there are actually databases circulated, and usually phishers and scammers and adware providers buy those databases of real emails, which are, of course, that's illegal, but they're sold. And that is another way it could be related to cookies, because sometimes those quote-unquote third-party websites, trusted third-party websites that your one very trusted organization trusts, maybe one of 10 out of those isn't so trustworthy.
So adware and phishing comes from cookies. Is that correct?
Information is, does the information for phishing come from cookies? Well, as I said, it could, but not necessarily. All you need for phishing is an email. Possibly, if you're trying to target a particular group, for example, through cookies, you find out users that actually have accounts with Bank of the West, and maybe others have accounts at Citibank, and still others have, Fleet. Oh, it's not Fleet anymore, Bank of America. So then you maybe write up a similar phishing email, but you substitute the right pictures from Bank of America and from Bank of the West to particular users. But that's not necessary. So phishing could be done completely separately from cookies. So I can distinguish it in a separate category.
You could use, you use cookies to find out where to fish.
Yes. But you can just, the supposition was that you use cookies to find out where you fish. But you can just go fishing anywhere, which is another possibility. And malware. So that's another big one. Well, I'll briefly mention packet sniffing too. We kind of skimmed over that, and there's no reason to go into detail here, but conceptually, again, you're sending packets over the network, IP packets, and anywhere on the wire meaning at any point from the source to the destination. So these are routers. Anywhere here could be a hacker. Packet sniffer. So packet sniffer could be, sniffer is either a software or actually the person who is sniffing, but usually software. And you use packet sniffer to inspect. You unwrap the packets and you inspect what's inside. What's inside is source IP, destination IP, but also all the content. So if you reconstruct particular packets from source to the destination, then you will have the complete picture of what this host sent to this host. And it's either server to client, or maybe it's client to server. Any which way, you can completely reconstruct the data that's being sent. And we'll see how that can be addressed in multiple ways. Otherwise, the whole network is pretty much TCP/IP itself is insecure. It has with it no security whatsoever. And that's how it was designed, again, to be simple, to not have any overhead of trying to establish security-based connections on authentication. And how would you find your destination if you wouldn't tell your source IP, for example, if all those random routers, all that complicated network, if that didn't have access to your source and destination IPs, then it would be really hard to make TCP/IP easy as it is. Easy is quote unquote. But it would be harder. It would be harder still if it had to include security. Incidentally, although this is an aside, we didn't cover this at all. IPsec is a protocol that tries to bundle up TCP/IP with security, but it's not universally used. It's pretty hard to implement now that there's the TCP/IP framework in place. Since we're on packet sniffers, let's just try to cover the alleviation mechanisms right away. One is to establish a secure tunnel. This is what's called tunneling, or VPN. Stands for Virtual Private Network. This is what's used at companies if you dial in from home. A secure path gets established through particular routers. It's sort of a tunnel where your data, everything you send, is encrypted end-to-end. Another one, instead of encrypting everything using VPN, just some applications encrypt your data. So when you browse typical websites, and something like CNN.com sends you the CNN web page, the CNN title page, Well, there's no reason to encrypt that, because anybody can access that anyway. So there's a packet sniffer sitting here, and reconstructing the CNN web page is pretty useless once he or she gets it. But if it's an email server, for example, then just that the email program will use encryption. So it's application level security. Same for websites. Sometimes when you finally access your banking account, online banking account, use SSL, as secure sockets layer. Basically encryption over the HTTP protocol. And I'll raise TCP/IP here.
Can you repeat that again, please?
Last part.
SSL is the secure sockets layer. It's a protocol that provides encryption for HTTP traffic. And HTTP, as you remember, is hypertext transfer protocol, so it transfers all the HTML files and HTML pages, any traffic on the web. So that means suddenly that everything you view through your browser gets encrypted. The way you can tell that is that in your address bar, instead of HTTP, you see HTTPS. //. Actually, it incidentally uses a different port than HTTP2. What port?
443.
443? Oh, you mentioned. Oh, is that a question? I'm not sure you'll be tested on this. Yeah, you might need to learn. HTTP regular is 80. And this is the one that's hard to guess because it's not one of the easy numbers. So finally, to malware.
Sorry, can I just ask a question about the SSL? Is it guaranteed secure or just, more than likely secure? Can hackers still decrypt?
The question is SSL guaranteed secure or more likely? Can hackers decrypt SSL? Yes and no. Well, theoretically, they could get lucky. If they start, it uses RSA encryption, which we're going to cover encryption last. But those are the long keys of primary numbers. Mathematically, they're very difficult. What does very difficult mean? It means that if you use long enough numbers, then it will take billions of years with current processing technology to discover the right key. Theoretically, if you start somewhere in the middle and just try randomly two numbers and just hit the right key, then you could, but the probability of that is zero. So for practical purposes, this is a secure protocol. And it uses different key lengths, but it is secure. So I'll erase this. Is there more questions? And now the whatware, malware. So that's malicious software, and easy one. Unfortunately, everything is called a virus these days. That's wrong. A virus is a type of malware that attaches to itself to a host, much like a real biological virus. A host could be maybe a file, executable file, or Word document, or something that you, an attachment that you open in an email. So this one we mentioned, again, it's attachments. Never open an attachment kind of thing. It used to be floppies, when you would enter a floppy, but not really because these are not used anymore. This virus, protecting yourselves against viruses is the easiest thing because you can follow the general guidelines. Not open suspicious attachments, even from your friends and family, because it could be they could have sent you, quote-unquote, unknowingly, the virus, because the virus, when they open their attachment, it just sent itself to in another attachment to everyone in their address book. Worms. These are much worse from your general security standpoint. Similar to viruses, but they are standalone. Software, so they don't need any host to transfer themselves. How do they do it? They're harder to write because they use security vulnerabilities in operating systems that have been discovered. And usually it takes some effort to even discover these operating system security vulnerabilities. So features that operating systems like Windows or Macs or Linux or Unix use to communicate with each other, some open ports, there's a way to communicate, and then something is insecure, but it hasn't been discovered. When it's discovered, a worm could be written exploiting that vulnerability. And there is little you can do other than protecting your system with antivirus software. Antivirus software, incidentally, AVs. They're not just antivirus. I think they're perpetuating this misguiding notion that everything is a virus, but they're not antivirus. They're anti-malware. I think that would be the right term. They don't just protect you from viruses, they also protect you from worms and adware. And Trojans. So these are, again, sort of Trojan horses. They need activation. So these are your nice .exe files, executable files on Windows, for example, that trick you into believing that maybe they're a nice cartoon show or something like that. Incidentally, the question that came up is why is there, are Macs generally more secure? They're generally more secure as opposed to Windows machines just because they're used less. Because 95% of consumers use Windows, it's just more effective for a virus writer to write a virus for a Windows system. And then malware. So this is the principal types, but we have other kinds of ware. Whatware? There's adware, spyware, and these come maybe as bundles to a worm, for example, or a virus. A virus or a worm or a Trojan, they can do something nasty, quote unquote, on your computer, like erase some information or just consume your computing resources or resend them. But they can do none of those things, but instead install pieces of adware or spyware on your computer. So adware, for example, would pop up ads next time you do search the web or use a particular application. Spyware looks for, it's sort of like extended cookies information, looks for more information about your habits than cookies may provide. Adware and spyware, incidentally, may also get bundled with legal software that you install yourself. Many of those web search toolbars, even from reputable companies, are essentially somewhat adware related, because they may prompt some ads or, you know, spyware as well. But it's a choice. So some of these are non-malicious, in fact, adware and spyware, and perfectly legal, but it's your choice whether you want to use the particular programs that host them. Oh, and finally, hoaxes. These are the little nice, you've got a virus emails, go and delete that kind of file, and that kind of file is completely innocent. So these are chain letters, usually. Fairly innocent from a technical standpoint, except they waste people's time. And sometimes, if you delete a particularly useful file, make it impossible to work further. And encryption. Any questions on this?
Could a cookie be used to put a virus on your machine?
Question is, could a cookie be used to put a virus on your machine? Don't see how.
What?
No, I don't see how. Why? Cookies are text files that are put by your browser, actually. The server that you visit may request to put a cookie, and your browser puts it in. And there's all text and just information. If you put a virus, has to be activated, it has to be executed. Any of these programs are programs, they're actually code that has to be run. You cannot run text. You can run a program, but you cannot run text if it's only treated as text. Incidentally, if that text was treated as a program, then it would be possible. But by design, these are separate. So I don't think it's possible.
Is that also the same reason why you can't, a virus must be sent as an attachment, and it can't be sent just as an email?
Yes, another question, is that the same reason why a virus has to be sent in as an attachment and not as an email? Exactly. So when you read an email, you treat it as text. So if that text was actually, a Java program, you would see the Java program in front of you, but you would actually need to pass it to the Java virtual machine to compile it, first of all, and then to pass it to the Java virtual machine. So there's several steps involved there. So you cannot execute text. And some encryption. Caesar cipher. How's Caesar spelled? Is it AE? Well,
I always have to look it up. It's terrible.
Now, this rot thing is rotation. So we did this in class. This was fun. Be sure to drink your Ovaltine. This was just rotating, so to speak, along the alphabet. If you pictured your alphabet as a dial, and Z would end here. So if you rotate 1, for example, then And instead, I don't remember if it's clockwise or counterclockwise. But say your A becomes a B, every A becomes a B, every B becomes a C, and so on and so forth. Every Z becomes an A to complete the loop. And we could do a couple of exercises with those. A pretty simple cipher. If you write, obviously it's hard by hand, but if you write a program that just rotates it, adds a particular, remember all the characters are represented in an ASCII table, so all you need to do is just add or subtract a particular number from the ASCII code. It's easy to decrypt these days, so it's not a secure algorithm. But this was used just as an example of where security starts, where encryption starts. And then there are much more complicated algorithms today. One we talked about is RSA, one used in SSL. Basically is based on a product of two prime numbers, and mathematically it is very hard to factor a particular long number that only consists of two factors, of two prime numbers. You don't need to know the details of that. And that's about all I have for security. That's very compressed. Maybe not enough compressed. I wanted to compress a little further, but any questions?
So in relation to that prime tag encryption, the question that was on the homework for this week, that 20-digit number, that was a trick question then. There is a way to...
The question is, was it a fun question? The last question of the most recent homework. Well, the number in the last question on the most recent homework is not that long. So there is actually a way to...
It's 20 digits.
20 digits. Well, it's not 100 digits or 2,000 digits. So I will stop the discussion at that.
So before we move on to the next little bit, going back to streaming, I just wanted to point out that we're actually streaming live. Hi, Ma. So, nifty.
So you can look at yourself giving the talk.
See now, why didn't y'all tell me my hair was all messed up? I'm just kidding. So we're going to talk about now web stuff. XHTML, CSS, SSI, and JavaScript. But before we jump into that, we need a little bit of a review on directory structures. You'll recall that if we wanted to graphically represent a directory structure, David started at the root, represented by a slash. On the FAS web server, being Linux, the root of the file system is root, or again, slash. All user directories are then contained in a home directory. So I'm giving it here sort of a genealogy metaphor with these lines and boxes. Off of home is a separate directory for every letter of the alphabet. Why? Because, for example, my username is R. Diaz, but there are thousands of faculty, staff, and students on FAS who have accounts, so just putting everything in R is a bit much. So off of these directories, so this would be B, C, so on to Z, off of these directories, the alphabet is repeated again, A through Z. So me being R Diaz, I'm somewhere in here with R. And then D, this is my taking off point for RDS. So my home directory is my user directory on my FAS account. It is several levels removed away from the root of the file system. But that's okay, because again, on Linux, the tilde is a nice little shortcut that says, get me to my account directory. But underneath RDS, in order to publish web files, I then have a public underscore HTML directory. Fortunately, again, when navigating, I can just say tilde public HTML. Underneath the public HTML directory is where I put my individual files, such as index.html, styles.css, any SSI includes that I want to schlep in there. We'll talk about that more in a little bit, but for now I just want to say that's the directory where you publish your web stuff. How do we see it? How do we get to it? We launch a browser and go to www.fas.harvard.edu/tilde my username. And at this point, if I stop there, I'm looking at a file called index.html in my public HTML directory. Okay, I see everybody writing frantically, so I will pause for a moment.
Can I just ask, because this question is either on last year's paper or it's in a homework that you have to write down the full name.
It's in the homework.
So should you write down FAS home A/A/ whatever, or just the tilde?
So the question is, how would you write the directory where your stuff lives? It depends on the question. I don't recall the one to which you're referring, so please tell me, did it ask how you would get to it from a browser or from an SSH session?
I have to look at it again.
So if it asked if you, how would you get to it from an SSH session or how would you secure list effect. It? Oh, okay, in Secure FX. Yeah, it's the whole shoot and match.
Okay.
But in a browser, it's just... it's much easier with our happy friend, the tilde.
So the top box with the line slash, that's the FAS server?
The question is the top box the FAS server? No, but it's the root directory of the file system on the FAS server. Was there a question?
Okay.
So XHTML, most documents on the web, just we're talking plain vanilla documents, we're not talking applications necessarily. Documents on the web are typically written in either HTML or XHTML. HTML is more strict. XHTML is more strict than plain old vanilla HTML. In an XHTML document, you have two distinct parts. You have the DTD, and then you have all the elements. The elements, too, can be subcategorized into sort of two areas, the head and the body. The head element must have a title element. This is the stuff that shows up in the title bar of your browser window. So if this is my Internet Explorer session, here's my address bar, HTTP, so on and so forth. The title. And I realize I'm writing a little small for everybody way in the back. The title is in the title bar of the window.
It's the top part, right?
Right. The body is all this other stuff. If you want it to be rendered in the browser, put it in the body. This is where the bulk, the majority, at least in this class, of your stuff, certainly all the content that's going to show up here should go. Okay? In general, and of course there are exceptions to this, like self-closing tags like dr, in general, an XHTML element most XHTML elements have a common anatomy. There's a start tag. Attributes and values. Content, and an end tag. So if we take, for example, an anchor element, which is what's used to create a hyperlink, this whole thing is the element. Our start tag is denoted by the first set of angle brackets. Our content is the stuff between both sets of angle brackets. And the end tag is the last set of angle brackets with the slash. Our element is A. Our attribute is href. And the value of that attribute is mit.edu.
Could you say that again, Ray, please?
Sure. The question was, could I repeat that? Yeah. The whole spiel here, from start to finish, is my XHTML element. I've only diagrammed one element. The start tag happens here in this first set of angle brackets.
Okay.
Between the two angle brackets is MIT. That's the content. And my end tag is here in the last set of angle brackets. This particular element has one attribute and one value. The attribute is href, which is my hyperlink reference, so that when I click on the word MIT, I get taken to the website mit.edu. And that attribute has a value of mit.edu. So hearkening back to Roman's security stuff and what David had mentioned a few lectures ago, just because a link happens to say bankofthewest.com, it can go anywhere.
Content. That's content.
So the question is, what's the MIT? This is the content. This is what's going to show up in the browser. So ignoring everything else that might be in my XHTML document, what am I going to see? MIT.
So the MIT.edu is not content?
No, absolutely not. It's within the angle brackets. The MIT.edu is not content. I could, for the sake of differentiation, because we've got MIT repeating a couple times here, I'll say Dan. We'll pick on him since he's not here. So what would show up in my browser? This is the content. It's the stuff that actually shows up. Okay?
Attribute then?
Yes, absolutely. Href
okay.
is an attribute.
Okay.
It is an attribute.
MIT is the value of this attribute.
Okay.
Is the A in front of href?
That's the element. That's the element name. That's the tag name. So the question was for you folks at home who can't hear. What was the A again? This is the
element.
This is the specific tag name. The whole thing is the element.
Yes, it's the HHT.
I would recommend, in preparation for the test, really going over the problem set on XHTML. And if I can take a liberty here, I just want to go back to the section notes because it links to a useful reference tool. So way down at the bottom of the section notes.
Of number 9?
Of XHTML, yes.
Yeah.
The very first helpful resource we link to is the complete list of XHTML 1.0 elements. I certainly would not recommend trying to learn them all, but some of the most common ones, paragraph, anchor, so you can create a link. List item, perhaps some of the formatting ones if you would like to use them, B for bold, I for italics, the line break, BR, a horizontal line, HR. How do you get a feel for which ones are the most commonly used? Take a look at what we've put on the section notes, which ones we've actually used on the section notes. You can do that in any browser by opening it, whether it's Internet Explorer, Firefox, Mozilla, Safari, what have you, by going to View, Source. ones that just keep occurring and recurring, I would suggest you at least be familiar with seeing and could recognize. Okay? Since we're running slightly over time, but I don't want to cheat anybody on content, we don't want it to be too lossy, right? So lossy that you can't recognize what's going on. I'll leave XHTML at that, and we'll go to cascading style sheets. The point behind CSS is to separate content from presentation. Our content happened in XHTML. We created a link in my doodle example of a hyperlink going to MIT that said Dan. We control the display of that with cascading style sheets. Should it be bold? Should it be italicized? Should it be red? Should it be blue? Should it be decorated when you hover over it with an underline? The anatomy of a CSS style in an external style sheet is you give the element name, angle brackets, the attribute, and the value. So an example of that would be if I wanted to make all of my paragraphs italicized for whatever reason, or I guess a simpler one would be we had a color scheme, so I wanted all of my paragraphs to be red. I would certainly urge you to, again, review the notes and be familiar with a slight variation on syntax between external style sheets, inline styles, and embedded styles. And even though we have to cut camera, I'll stay around a little bit after if people have questions about the differences between the three. So the question was, would I repeat that? I urge you to be able to at least recognize. You don't have to be able to generate from scratch like I did just here, but recognize the syntactical differences between styles from an external style sheet, styles that are written in line, for example, with the span element, and styles that are embedded, the ones that happen in the head of the document within the style element. Server-side includes, or SSI, are tokens that get executed on the server side. These are things like insert date time. You know, I think David gave an example of rather than hard coding it with something like this document last updated on you can insert a token there. Another common token is the include virtual. Tokens are written in such a way that they look like XHTML comments, comments being angle bracket, exclamation mark, dash, dash, closed with a dash, dash, angle bracket. Part of the reason for this is if your files live on a web server that knows how to execute server-side includes, but then for whatever reason happen to be copied to or moved over to a server that does not or is configured not to execute server-side includes, at least you won't render garbage in the web browser. And really quickly, eyeballing the time again, we'll get to JavaScript. I think the important takeaway here is remembering the example of pseudocode. You can think of this as sort of a plain English example of how a program should run, what's the logic behind it, using the find phone number in the phone book example from lecture. You could express your pseudocode as step one, go to the middle of the phone book. Step two is the letter you're on before or after the first letter of the name, so on and so forth. Is everybody okay with that? I see a frown, or two, or three, or a few more. Any questions? Okay.
Is that as in-depth as the exam's going to be on JavaScript?
I beg your pardon?
Is that as in-depth as it's going to be expected of us to talk about JavaScript on the exam?
So the question was, is the exam portion of JavaScript going to be as in-depth as this is pseudocode?
Yeah.
The answer is no. It's going to be more in-depth than that. I would definitely recommend reviewing the lecture notes. And as I said, even if we have to cut camera, I'll stick around and answer questions. But I'm not done yet, so we're not hopefully cutting just yet. In Java, you have certain, well, in programming in general, you have certain constructs like conditionals, loops, functions. I would certainly recommend that you be able to recognize them visually and at least in the form of pseudocode be able to write your own. What's a conditional? This is also called a branch. Its most common form is if something, then do something else, else do yet another thing. So an example of that is, if today is Saturday, then please come to the exam review, else study very hard for the test next week. An example of a loop would be when you want to iterate something until a condition is met. If socks on feet is not equal to 2, again borrowing from lecture, then, or actually while socks on feet is not equal to 2, then find a sock and put it on. There really is no else, because once the condition has been met, you're outside the loop. Functions you can think of as sort of discrete blocks of code that do something. David gave a few examples of this. Document.write. Hello world. I would definitely recommend going through the two or three example files posted on the course website that we went through last Thursday. Okay. Again, this has been a very whirlwind review, but it's 5 o'clock. We're already 15 minutes over time. So I do want to include your questions in the videotape. So at this point, any questions? Yes.
You mentioned the Section 9 homework.
Uh-huh.
It's not due until the week after the exam. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Anything that's been covered. The question is, the XHTML homework. Will there be material on the exam that's also in the homework, even though it's due later? Yes, absolutely. Any of the material that's been in the lectures since exam one up until this past Thursday is fair game for exam two. Okay. Any other questions? Any looks of horror that you want to share on camera? Okay. Okay, well, thank you very much. Like I said, we'll stick around for a little bit and answer questions more in depth. Distance students, please send us email and we will answer your questions. Also, we can, on the course website, you'll notice there's a little chat room here. I'm typically on here about a half an hour every day, so you can certainly schedule time to meet me here and ask questions and get feedback in a more real-time pace. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you.